Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. How can technology play a role in driving global economic growth? Find out at morganstanley.com/inclusivegrowth. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, and Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC, members SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. Hello, and welcome to the Markets Mayhem edition of the Politico Money podcast, coming at you in a crazy period for Wall Street, where we saw the Dow sell off about 1,700 points over 2 days, only to bounce back on Tuesday nearly 600 points. It's been a return to the kind of intense volatility we haven't seen in many years on Wall Street, where we're in this placid period where the only direction seemed to be up. Well, stocks go two ways. And we have the perfect person to explain it all to you, why it happened, what's going to happen next, and what you should make of all of it. He's Mohammed El Arian. He's the chief economic advisor at Allianz, former co-CEO of bond giant PIMCO, ran the Harvard Endowment, has been involved in markets for many years, and I hope you'll enjoy this conversation and Mohammed making some sense out of all the madness for us. So please enjoy this conversation with Mohammed El Arian. All right, so we're joined by Mohammed El Arian. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. Great to have you.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And Mohammed, as most listeners will know, has been co-CEO of PIMCO. He was the in charge of the Harvard Endowment. He's now the chief economic advisor at Allianz. He's a master of all things markets, not just in the U.S., but globally. And he and I are sitting here talking to each other at 4 o'clock Eastern time on Monday after a really remarkable day on Wall Street. The Dow just closed down over 1,100 points after closing down over 600 points on Friday. So we've gotten, you know, a two-day collapse in the stock market. And, you know, as a caveat, this will go out Wednesday morning. So we have to, you know, acknowledge to listeners that the market may have bounced back on Tuesday. Who knows? We could be back up another 1,000 points. But fact of the matter is, volatility is back on Wall Street in a big way. And we've got the perfect person to explain to us what the heck is going on. So, Mohammed, what the heck is going on?
I mean, as you say, volatility is back. The context is important, Ben. We're coming from a period in which there was virtually no financial market volatility whatsoever. Last year alone, we saw six of the seventh lowest measures for volatility in history. So what we're doing is adapting. I think the most important fundamental technical development, I want to stress, this is a technical change, not an economic or fundamental change. The most important technical development is people are questioning something that they've believed in for a very long time, which is that the buy the dip dynamic will always prevail. When it failed to prevail last week, when it failed again to prevail on Monday early on, the bottom got taken out of the market. Now, for those of us who have seen technically driven market, this is not particularly new, but like the Patriots fans are discovering, for those who were used to really, really good time, this can be quite unsettling.
Indeed. I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second because I'm going to you know, as an NFL referee, like throw up a flag every now and then to kind of discuss technical terms. When Mohammed says buy the dip, that essentially means, you know, every time we've had these sell-offs recently, immediately buyers come in and pick up stocks on the assumption that we're heading ever higher. That hasn't happened. That didn't happen Friday. It didn't happen today. So we got the 1,100-point decline. And I should say, because of his Patriots reference, that Mohammed is a giant New York Jets fan. He grew up in New York. He's a Jets fan. He's a Mets fan. And he and I have bonded over the last couple of years over our sports fandoms. And, you know, in my case, the Redskins, who always lose. In his case, the Jets, who often lose. But we'll get back into sports in a little bit. But I want to dig a little bit more into this return of volatility on Wall Street. Now, everybody explaining this big dip the last couple of days is saying it's fear about the Federal Reserve, and specifically that they're going to have to raise interest rates faster because the economy is heating up. So this is this weird situation where good news about the economy, and we've gotten some good news recently. We got, you know, solid wage increase in the last jobs report. We've got the Atlanta Fed saying the U.S. economy might be growing at 5.2%. So there's all this good sounding stuff, and we got corporate tax cuts, and all these companies are announcing, you know, wage increases and bonuses. So this wave of seemingly good economic news, and yet stocks are selling off so hard. And this is the situation where good news is bad news. Explain to us that phenomenon. Why would good news about the economy be bad news for the stock market?
So let me tell you what the narrative is out there and why I disagree with it. So the narrative is the economy is picking up not only domestically, but globally. That means that the Federal Reserve is going to have to hike interest rates aggressively, and that other central banks, in particular the ECB and the Bank of Japan, so the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan, will also be taking their foot off the accelerator. And the result of that is going to be a massive sell-off in financial markets, not just stocks, but also bonds. So you'll hear that narrative out there. I understand where it's coming from, but it ignores the context in which we're operating. And the context in which we're operating, simply put, is that equity markets went a very long way up very quickly. And you tend to get technical corrections. You tend to get air pockets. Just look at the numbers. Last year alone, the Dow was up 25%. The S&P was up 19%. We had 71 daily records on the Dow. And all this happened in the context of the bond market, which is the safe asset, not going down in price, but going up in price. So we've come from a very peculiar phase. In January alone, the S&P was up 7.5%. So if you look at the context, we came very far, very rapidly, and we are now having a technical adjustment. Within that, the economy is improving, and that is going to slowly close the gap in something that you've heard me say for a long time, which is elevated asset prices and what used to be sluggish fundamentals, and they are now picking up. And if we can close that gap with the fundamentals converging to the higher asset valuation, that is actually a good outcome. But it's not going to be without volatility. It is the lack of volatility that was the big surprise, and it was a surprise for quite a long time.
Right. So now we've got that volatility back. So, all right, I'm listening to this podcast. I am not a Wall Street trader. I'm not deeply involved in the markets day to day. But obviously, you know, I have a 401k. I have some investments. And, you know, I'm hearing in the news, oh, my God, the Dow is down 1,700 points over a couple of days. And maybe I go online and look at my current balance and it's dipped down a little bit. What do I do? I mean, personally, my advice to that person would be do nothing. You just wait it out and, you know, we'll resume this increase. But what is your advice to the average person who sees this kind of volatility come back? Just ignore it and move on with your life, or what?
You know, it's hard to answer because you don't know what the circumstances of that individuals are. So I tell people, the first question you need to ask yourself is, what mistake can I not afford to make? And that's a really important question. Most people like asking themselves, what can go right? And to the extent that they ask themselves about a mistake, it's normally a mistake they can afford to make. We don't like answering the question, what mistake can I not afford to make? So the first thing that any investor, whether it's with the S&P, whether it's with their 401k, whether it's with the education funds for their kids, understand what mistake you cannot afford to make. If one of those mistakes is that I may have to sell tomorrow, I may have to sell in the next 6 months, then you don't want to be 100% exposed to equities at this point. You want to have some dry powder. If, however, you can underwrite the ups and downs, you should not overreact to any daily or weekly moves in markets. You should have a diversified portfolio, and you should look to exploit two things. One is what I call secular themes, things that play out over time, the maturation of emerging markets, the role of technology. And then the second one is you want to exploit structural themes, because you're able to do something in the market as a long-term investor that others who are short-term traders cannot do that. So focus on those, and to the extent that you're already diversified and you can afford volatility in the market, Okay, just focus on the long term.
That seems like good advice. I want to ask you about the importance that the change at the Fed has in all of this. This market decline started on Friday, which happened to be outgoing Fed Chair Janet Yellen's last day at the Fed, and it continued and accelerated Monday, Jay Powell, the new Fed Chair's first day at the Fed. Now, there are plenty of people who criticized President Trump for getting rid of Janet Yellen on the argument that she's had a really successful tenure. Stocks are up. The economy's doing well. She's, as you call it, this beautiful normalization of interest rates. She's doing it gently. Wall Street really came to love her, which is surprising given that some, you know, feared her. Republicans didn't like her. But now she's gone. Powell is in. Markets are collapsing. Is there any connection between those things? Like, are Wall Street traders and investors a little bit frightened of what they don't know is going to happen at the Fed?
So I see no connection whatsoever between the timing of the transition and the nature of the transition at the Fed and what has happened in equity markets. I think if you want to look for a trigger, it will be the strong employment report. That will be a better trigger. But also, it will just be what an amazing January we had. And as people look to rebalance after January, and that's what people normally do at the end of a month and the beginning of a month, is they rebalance. And when equities go up as much as they did in January, you will get a rebalancing away from equities. So I think it's a total coincidence that the two events, the change of leadership at the Fed and the equity market, happen at the same time. In terms of the broader question, I see Chair Powell as a continuity chair. He has been aligned with former Chair Yellen's policies. They obviously think alike. You have him supported by a very deep bench in terms of the staff. So I'm not a buyer that when someone comes in, you're going to see a major change in Fed policy, and especially not when it is Chair Powell, and especially not when the beautiful normalization has been going so well. So I expect the Fed to deliver on its policy guidance, which is 3 rate hikes in 2018, starting probably in March. The balance of risk, is it more likely to be 2 hikes or 4 hikes if it's not 3? I think it's very balanced right now. And what's interesting to me, Ben, is unlike last year, the market has converged to the Fed policy guidance much faster than most people expected.
Yeah. Let's try to explain to people why it is that Wall Street reacted so negatively to the jobs report. On the top line, employment number wasn't that much different than the trends that we've seen. We continue to be in this very good path of job creation of around 200,000 per month. But there was an uptick in wage growth to a pace of 2.9% year over year, which, you know, probably to the layperson doesn't sound like that much, but it freaked everybody out. And I wonder, you know, people listening to this will think, isn't this what we've been waiting for? We've had this economic recovery that's gone on for, you know, 9 or 10 years, and it's brought the unemployment rate down a lot, but it hasn't made people feel a lot better, partly because their wages haven't gone up that much. So everybody keeps waiting for the increase in wages. Finally, here it is. It shows up, and Wall Street hates it and sells off. Why was it a bad thing?
So first, it's very good for the economy. And there were two aspects in particular that were notable in the report issued on Friday. The first is that the economy created 200,000 jobs. That was above market expectations. And why is that important? Because we are quite a way into a very long cycle. The economy is expected at this stage of the cycle, and it's been going on for a long time, to create somewhere between 80 to 120,000 jobs. Well, it created 200,000 jobs. So the first thing that was notable is very solid job creation. The second thing is that for a long time, the wage rate hasn't responded to the decline in the unemployment rate, which is now 4.1%. Normally, when the unemployment rate comes down, employers find it harder to employ people, so they have to pay more. But one of the big puzzles, and there's been 3 big puzzles in economics in the last couple of years, one of the big puzzles is that wages haven't gone up. So the second thing that happened on Friday is not only did we get a solid beat on wage creation, we also got a solid wage creation wage increase number. Earnings went up by 2.9%. So the market was surprised by a better than expected job creation. The market looked at wages and got, wow, they are coming back, which is good for the economy, but it's different from what they have seen in the past. And there was a reaction in the fixed income market, in the bond market, which was a significant rise up in yields. I think that that reflects a healthier economy. It is going up for good reasons, not bad. What are bad reasons? A policy mistake, well, we don't have that, or that people are more worried about the sovereign credit of the United States, and that's not happening. So this was a good increase in interest rates driven by positive economic factors that start addressing what has been the new normal of too many years of economic growth that has been too low and insufficiently inclusive.
We'll be back with more of my conversation with Mohammed El Arian, but first, a word from our sponsor.
A message from Morgan Stanley. Across the globe, disparities in income, well-being, and living standards are growing. Opportunities to invest in technologies that provide access to critical tools that create opportunities to close economic gaps, such as finance, healthcare, and education, exist in a wide range of geographies. Learn more at morganstanley.com/inclusivegrowth. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, and Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC, members SIPC.
Okay, so let's talk about President Donald Trump. And I ask this just because I just wrote a story about it, and it's on my mind, is the nature of his stock market tweets has been to, give credit to himself for what the markets have done, which then, of course, you would give him blame if we have a big sell-off, but maybe we bounce back, whatever. So let's forget about that, but just focus on the content of the tweet saying the market's advance is the result of my policies. Now, obviously, you've said that the Tax Cut Act, whatever you think about its specific particulars, is stimulative, and clearly some of the market gains since the election are related to that. But this is a long-term market advance that began in 2009. It seems to me a little bit unfair for him to wrap himself in this and say, this is all my stock market. I mean, the stock market went up a lot under President Barack Obama. So how much credit should Trump get?
Okay, so there's multiple aspects to your question. I hope I answered them all, but something makes me suspect that you're going to come back and complain that I didn't. Okay.
Very good point, I will.
You went all the way back to 2009. So the low was March 2009. The first recovery of the market was simply a relief that we hadn't slipped into a multi-year economic depression. And I cannot stress enough how close we got to that. There's many reasons why we didn't slip, but the important thing is we didn't. And the market was massively relieved, and we got a significant bounce. The second major bounce came from what I mentioned earlier, liquidity, from money from central banks, starting really with the announcement in August 2010 by then-chair Ben Bernanke that he would use unconventional policies to pursue an economic objectives. And the only way he could do that is through what economists call the asset market. What do? Very simply, you push up asset prices so that when you and I open our 401k, we see that we are wealthier. What does that do? You hope that that triggers the wealth effects. That's economic jargon for saying because we are better off, we will spend more. As we spend more, companies invest more. So the second stage of the market was a liquidity-driven market, as we discussed earlier, that had not just central banks throwing money at the market, but also had companies buying back their shares. And then the third part of the rally was more policy driven, and it was part of a global phenomenon. So it wasn't just a US phenomenon where we got a pivot to pro-growth policies. We also got economic surprises on the upside in Europe in particular. So we are now in the midst of a synchronized pickup in growth that is multidimensional. So you have three different phases of this rally. And like any other rally, okay, you will get short-term corrections. I can't stress this enough. What has been unusual is not that we're getting a correction now, is that we went a long time. Let me give you Einstein a stunning number. We went over 400 trading days without a 5% correction from the highest level of the market. That is unheard of. Unheard of that we went such a long time without a minor correction. Why? Because the buy on dip mentality was so strong. Nothing works better on Wall Street than a simple strategy that pays you. And what has been that simple strategy for a while now is no matter what the dip is, buy it, buy it, buy it. And in the process, you push asset prices to very elevated levels.
All right. So you won't criticize Trump and his tweets or taking credit for the economy, though I do take the entirety of your answer to kind of get at that. But let's talk about the tax cut plan in particular and some of the warnings that are out there about it. And obviously, it's had some nice beneficial impact so far on the bonuses and the announcements of wage increases and some of the investments in U.S. manufacturing capacity. All very good. The question that some people raise is, how big of an impact is this going to have on the U.S. debt and deficit? We've already seen the Treasury Department say that they're going to push up, or other people say that the Treasury will have to push up the date by which the debt limit needs to be raised because we have less government money coming in, less revenue coming in because we cut taxes in this way. The Treasury is going to have to borrow more in 2018 than it expected to because of the fact that we cut corporate tax rates this much and we're getting less tax revenue. And then you have the criticism that you're dumping all this money into the system through, you know, more share buybacks and dividends and also wage increases and bonuses in a way that's going to be inflationary. So you've got too much debt and deficit run up from this and then too much immediate inflationary spending by corporations. Are we at risk here of this tax cut package kind of coming at the wrong time and pushing us in the wrong direction?
Okay, so three elements to your question. First, I think it's unambiguous that the tax bill will lead to a higher deficit, higher funding needs for the government, and higher debt. That's unambiguous. But the question is, does it erode debt sustainability? Why do economists worry about debt? Is because of the notion that at some stage you cannot sustain your debt. And that question is a very different question. Debt sustainability is a fraction. It has a numerator and has a denominator. The numerator is the debt and the deficit. How much do you have to pay? When do you have to pay it? What is the interest rate? That is the numerator. The denominator is equally important, and that is your ability to pay. Are you growing? Are you generating additional income so that you can maintain your standard of living and also pay for your debt service? Okay, so it's really important when you talk about debt and deficits to remember it's a fraction. So the key question is not just will the tax bill result in a higher deficit and higher debt, but to what extent will that be compensated and offset by higher growth, by ability to generate more income, and by ability to push up not just short-term growth, but long-term growth. Is it going to be inflationary? You know, for a long time, people were worried, including the Fed, were worried about inflation being too low, not too high. You had the former Chair Yellen talk about the mystery of inflation. Why hasn't inflation not gone up? Wages weren't going up. You and I discussed this earlier in the podcast, and that was having an impact on what I call the politics of anger, the feeling that the economy wasn't serving everybody because the average wages weren't going up. So somewhat higher inflation, as long as it's contained, and I think it will be contained, and higher wage growth is actually part of the solution, not part of the problem. Which leaves the third element of your question, is it coming at the wrong time? Most of us will agree that it would have been nice to have fiscal reforms 2, 3, 4 years ago. I don't think of anybody that would disagree with that statement. But the political setup was such that it was impossible to get any major legislation through Congress. You've written about this. We now have a window to get that. So should it have come earlier in a perfect world? Yes. But we mustn't allow the best to be the enemy of the good. And I would conclude by one thing. Let's not forget the Fed is reducing its stimulus policies. The Fed is taking its foot off the accelerator. It has stopped its asset purchases. It has announced a plan for reducing its balance sheet. And it has raised rates already, and it intends to raise rates 3 more times this year. So what you're getting is what economists call a rebalancing of the fiscal monetary balance. Less monetary stimulus and more fiscal stimulus. And if that is calibrated, an important if, but if it's calibrated, it's actually a good thing for the economy.
Okay, I'm going to let you go soon because I know you've got other things to do, and nobody likes an overly long podcast, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your own career and trajectory. You've been mentioned as a potential candidate for vice chair of the Fed, as well as president of the New York Fed. Are you interested in one or the other of those jobs, and can you tell us anything about the status of them?
So as you know, Ben, my career started in the public sector, where I worked as an international civil servant for 15 years. Then I was turning 40, and I had never tried the private sector. So I made a transition to the private sector, and it's been a wonderful transition. And I've always been interested in public sector work. All I can tell you in response to your question specifically is that I'm extremely honored to have my name among, you know, lots of names that you and others have reported to be under consideration for a position in the Federal Reserve System. And I'm just, you know, very honored that that is the case.
Very good. Very politic answer. And I should be remiss in not mentioning my mom. Ann White is a huge fan of yours. You two met at, I think, an event either at the NASDAQ or in Washington. And now she always asks me about how you are and how you're doing. And she's very eager to get your input on things. So she may be the number one listener of this podcast.
So please say hello to her. Unlike you, I remember exactly where I met her. It was in Washington. It was at the annual meeting of the IIF, Institution for International Finance. You were, of course, moderating all the sessions. She was out there to admire her son, and I had a wonderful chat with her in the green room, and please convey to her my very best.
I will. And now, before we close, let's get a little bit of an outlook on the upcoming seasons for your Jets and your Mets. Are you sanguine in your hopes for either team, and who's going to be the quarterback for the Jets next year?
So I'm going to go through my usual cycle, which is at this stage, I am very realistic that both teams have a lot of rebuilding to do. They don't have the talent needed to get to the playoffs and make it deep into the playoffs. So that is stage one, the rational, analytical Mohammed. Stage two is when they'll win one game, and I'll somehow believe that this year is going to be different and that somehow magic can happen. And then stage three will be deep disappointment. And, you know, I can predict is that cycle. I mean, I would like to help my friends in Philadelphia. I think that they may have a quarterback controversy on their hands. And I would hope that they would be able to enter some discussion with the Jets so that we can help them with their quarterback controversy.
They could take you could take Nick Foles or Carson Wentz off their hands, for that matter. It would be so kind of the Jets to do that. Now, of course, you know, my man Kirk Cousins is out there too. Would you be excited to see Kirk Cousins throwing for the Jets?
Yeah, I would, and that I would also like him to do really well so that I can, you know, talk to my Redskin fans. You remember, I lived 15 years in D.C., and they included the years where the Redskins were actually winning things. So it would be a nice payback.
Yeah. All right. Leave us with one thought for the poor average investor folk who sees markets melting down for a couple of days. And perhaps by the time people are listening to this, they've melted back up. Should we just chill out a little bit? Tell us how very brief summary of how Mohamed El-Erian deals with this kind of volatility. Very short.
Very short is what's happening is not massively abnormal. It's just that we haven't seen it for a while, and it actually is good. Okay, it tends to improve the functioning of markets as long as the sell-off is contained.
Very good. Mohamed El-Erian, thank you so much for joining us. You're very kind with your time, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap for the latest edition of the Politico Money Podcast. So glad you could be with us. Hope you learned a little bit about what's going on in markets, where they're headed next. We'll have much more on this in future Politico Money Podcasts. And if you are enjoying the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. I'd like to thank Mohamed El-Erian, and of course, thank my producer, Bridget Mulcahy, and look forward to meeting you back here next week for more Politico Money.